From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Alabamians finally vote today for their next senator, choosing between the former Republican Judge Roy Moore, known for refusing to remove a Ten Commandments plaque before he was recently accused of sexual misconduct with teenagers when he was in his 30s, and Doug Jones, known for prosecuting two KKK members decades after the Birmingham church bombings, now suddenly the first Democrat with the chance to win a higher office in Alabama in 20 years. It's also a day when President Trump is criticizing women who have accused him of unwanted sexual advances, and he's also making insinuations about a New York congresswoman. Mara Liasson is NPR national political correspondent. And Mara, as you know, Roy Moore arrived on horseback to vote today. CNN missed the shot because there was so much media there. They couldn't even get to him. What are you watching for today in Alabama?
What I'm watching for is to see if Doug Jones, the Democrat, can beat the very daunting odds against a Democrat, just structurally and mathematically. I mean, can Doug Jones make African-American turnout so high that they're 25% of the electorate tonight? That's something that has rarely ever been done. Can he get a third of the white vote? That's what a Democrat needs to win in Alabama. Barack Obama only got 15% of the white vote in 2012. And can Doug Jones get enough crossover Republicans? It's not enough for him to win, to get Republicans to stay home or to send in a write-in vote. He needs Republicans to actually cross over and vote for a pro-choice Democrat, and that is hard in Alabama.
Well, that's what we've been hearing, that the one issue that seems to be immutable here is abortion for many of these voters. And so they are unable to perhaps cross over, even if they are not for Roy Moore. But Doug Jones voted at 8:30 this morning at Brookwood Baptist Church in Mountain Brook and cited his prosecution of the Birmingham church bombers, you know, those little girls who were killed in the church bombing in the 60s. He prosecuted the bombers decades later as a way of, you know, pointing to his alliance with the African-American community. But Roy Moore has Steve Bannon. He spoke last night. He criticized mainstream Republicans who refused to back Roy Moore. Let's listen.
There's a special place in hell for Republicans who should know better.
And Mara, Bannon, they're clearly referring to first daughter Ivanka Trump, who commented about Moore that there's a special place in hell for people who prey on children. What do you make of that?
Well, there's a war inside the Republican Party here, and right now the president is winning, and the president has thrown in his lot in with Steve Bannon. Remember, he was on the opposite side during the primary when Bannon supported Moore, and Trump decided to follow the suggestions of mainstream establishment Republicans and go for the sitting incumbent Senator Luther Strange, who lost that primary to Moore. But I think there is still a split in the party. The RNC and the president, Steve Bannon, all in for Roy Moore, and other people, Ivanka Trump had that quote, so did Mark Short, who's the legislative director at the White House. And there are several Republican senators who say that they would vote to expel Moore. And notably, the Republican Senate campaign committee, led by Cory Gardner from Colorado, is not supporting Moore, and they never have budged on that. So I think the Moore story is not over. The stakes are high for Republicans. No matter what happens, it's kind of tails you win, heads I lose. In other words, if Moore wins, they're going to have to deal with all the repercussions of having an accused child molester in their conference in the Senate. If he loses, that will be a tremendous blow to the president.
Yeah. What about the president's tweets today? First, hitting back at his accusers. That's probably not surprising. These are the women who came forward again yesterday. He says, I don't know them. I've never met them. But he also tweeted about New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who demanded Trump's resignation yesterday. The president wrote that she is someone who would come to my office begging for campaign contributions not so long ago and would do anything for them.
That was pretty amazing. And of course, Kirsten Gillibrand responded. She called that a sexist smear. Elizabeth Warren went so far as to call it slut shaming. And although somebody will have to explain to me exactly why that is. But the Democrats believe this is a good issue for them. Gillibrand said the president is trying to silence me. In terms of fact-checking that tweet, apparently Gillibrand did meet with Trump once in 2010, but Ivanka was there. And the other thing that I thought was interesting about the president's tweet is he's so worked up about this, he went on to say she's now in the ring fighting against Trump. Whoa, that kind of elevates her. And I think think that that's what his tweets do. Whether it's LeVar Ball or Kirsten Gillibrand, he elevates his opponents.
Yeah.
But fighting for his life and for his political legitimacy is kind of built into his DNA. It's what he gets up every morning and tweets about. And conflict is his MO, and making it as dramatic as possible. I don't know exactly where this one goes, other than to give Gillibrand a higher profile.
Well, one wonders what is going on with his agenda. The tax plan he wants by Christmas, all of these other things that are supposed to be going on. We will get to that at another day. Mara Liasson, national political correspondent for NPR, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to the latest figures to fall as a result of allegations of sexual misconduct. Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker and CNN and celebrity chef Mario Batali, host of ABC's The Chew. Lizza denies the allegations against him. Batali has apologized for the allegations against him. Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Jeremy.
And let's start with Ryan Lizza, who has reported in Washington for decades. Just this year, he had that famous phone conversation with Anthony Scaramucci, the short-lived White House communications director that ended up costing Scaramucci his job after just a matter of days. Here's Lizza on CNN talking about that.
What President Trump has done is he's just the White House was already deeply factionalized, and putting Anthony Scaramucci in that job was like throwing a grenade into an ongoing civil war in the White House.
What has Lizza been accused of? Do we know?
We really don't. What The New Yorker said in dismissing him, severing ties, as they put it, was that he had engaged in improper sexual conduct. They wouldn't give any details. They say out of deference to the woman filing the complaint, and her attorney, Doug Wigdor, has essentially said that she has wanted anonymity and also confidentiality about her complaint. Lizza sort of preemptively put out a statement saying he hadn't done anything wrong, that he had had a respectful relationship, that he hadn't violated any magazine policies, something I think the magazine would push back on if it were speaking publicly, and that he said that it acted hastily without getting the full facts against, the current climate of heightened concern about these kinds of issues.
And he's been fired from The New Yorker. He's been suspended from CNN. What has he said about how these two organizations have handled this?
He just says this is really intemperate, that as I said, that this was a respectful relationship, indicating essentially a consensual and non-abusive exchange. We just don't know different. I will say that her attorney, Doug Wigdor, who's in the middle of numerous lawsuits against Fox News, some of which are directly related to issues of sexual harassment, Wigdor on the woman's behalf said this was not a respectful relationship. This was improper sexual conduct. And he very much rejects the characterization that Liz is offering. We really don't know. It's one of the clearest denials offered by a figure in prominent media in recent weeks of such conduct out of hand.
And then there is the chef and restaurant owner Mario Batali. Here he is on ABC's The Chew.
I have olive oil. I have vinegar. I have chichi beans. I have black olive pesto. I have bread. I have the Rachel Ray look going on right now.
Now, Batali is alleged to have sexually harassed many women going back decades. What do we know about the charges there and how he's responded?
So the website Eater talked to four women who were employees of his, one of whom I believe was an ex-employee of his, who described sort of pretty extreme physical groping and putting his hands on, forgive the lewdness of this. In one instance, a woman had wine inadvertently spilled on her, and he reached out and used his excuse to deeply grope and grab her breasts. And she said she was just sort of astonished and walked away. And a number of other women talked about ways in which he demeaned them. He forced one woman to straddle him physically. Just deeply inappropriate physical behavior. He copped to it. He said, this is essentially what I did, and I apologize. He's stepping away from management of the companies. He has essentially a kind of empire there, and we're going to have to see the degree to which the brand of the companies that he's been affiliated with take a hit from this. He's been asked by ABC also to step away from that TV show.
Amazing. Just another one in a long string now. And we've got one here in public media. David, as you know, Tom Ashbrook, the host of WBUR's On Point, which is distributed by NPR, has been placed on leave because of allegations that in his case appear to have a lot to do with what was perceived as a hostile workplace culture and bullying. Does this fall into the category of sexual misconduct, or is this different?
You know, I think this falls under the umbrella of the larger umbrella of the kinds of conduct that's being much more closely scrutinized. There, you know, one can draw reasonably distinctions between sexual assault, which has been alleged by against such figures as Harvey Weinstein, sexual harassment, sexism, and deeply charged workplaces. In WBUR's case, Ashbrook's been accused of creating essentially a hostile work environment, but also of saying sexually creepy things. Those comments have not been specified. Offering back rubs to women, although not men, that he appears to have offended. BUR's done a pretty good job of covering itself. I've also spoken to three women who used to work with or for Ashbrook at WBUR, and they said, you know, at times he would make just astonishingly flagrantly offensive, profane statements about women, some of which I cannot repeat on the air, you know, and yet he has said, listen, I'm demanding, you know, while he's said in a statement to the station, I'm sure that once the facts come out, people will see me for who I am, flawed but caring and decent in all my dealings with others. At the moment, he's on leave, and this is being reviewed by BUR.
And of course, Robin and I, both employees of WBUR, full disclosure there. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
The busy holiday travel season is upon us. 51 million passengers are expected to fly between December 15th and January 4th on U.S. airlines. So for our View from the Top conversation today, that's our series of conversations with leaders. We're joined by the CEO of Southwest Airlines, Gary Kelly. He's in Dallas. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks, Jeremy, for having us.
And how are things going for Southwest right now?
We're having a great year. We've been through a very transformative period here in Southwest history over the last 5 to 10 years, and just really reaping the benefits of the hard work over that time period. But we've launched a new reservation system this year for the first time in 30 years, launched a new version of the Boeing 737 for the first time in 20 years. Fuel prices are pretty stable, and we're just looking forward to a great end of the year and a wonderful 2018.
I should say, by the way, that I have long been, just because of where I've lived in the past, an American Airlines flyer, although I do occasionally fly Southwest, in part because you fly to St. Louis. I've got family in St. Louis. I can go direct there. And one of the things that I notice is that as an infrequent customer of Southwest, I do like the fact that I get treated just the way I would if I were a frequent flyer. I get free check bags and I can, you know, board early if I want to pay a little extra. Why does that model work for you when it doesn't work for the big legacy carriers?
Well, you more or less sum up what we're trying to do. We are trying to make sure that every single customer feels important on Southwest Airlines. We love to say there is no second class. Other airlines will take great care of their elite customers, and then the rest of us kind of go to the back of the bus. And that's just not what we try to do at Southwest. We try to take very good care of everyone. That's why we have the best customer satisfaction ranking over decades.
Do you see a day when Southwest will have first class?
You know, I don't. I do think it's important to quickly add, never say never. But we're the largest airline in the country, and we have among the top brand rankings in the country. We've got a good thing going. Our employees are proud of what they do. Our customers like what we offer. And, you know, why change that?
Who do you think of as your biggest competitor?
Well, we compete with all the airlines. It's a brutally competitive business and always has been. Most customers look for two things when they're looking for a flight. They're looking for, first of all, the most convenient way to get where they want to go. So that's the flight schedule. And then number two, they're looking for the lowest price. So we have smaller, newer carriers that have low costs. They pay very low wages. And then we compete with high-cost global carriers. And what we try to do is offer great service with very low prices. You mentioned we don't charge bag fees and change fees, so we don't like to nickel and dime. And that's our niche, it's worked very well. But we compete with everybody.
So what do you think of an airline like Spirit, which does kind of nickel and dime and charge for every little thing?
Well, you know, it's a free country, so I like the contrast. It's a wonderful way for us to illustrate how we're different. It's not what we do. It's not what we stand for. I don't think that with that kind of a product, they'll ever be the largest airline in the country. But nonetheless, they have a good business and they do have a following. So we're all about serving our customers and all about competing. And we just want to make sure that we beat them.
There's another difference that I want to ask you about, which is that Southwest, unlike many of the other airlines, you can only buy the tickets on Southwest's website. You can't buy it on Kayak or Expedia or some of these other sites. Why is that?
Well, and actually, a lot of the things we've been talking about support that strategy. And by the way, that's not new. That's really been our strategy since day one. So if you watch television, you'll note that we are literally the only airline that consistently advertises on television. So what we're trying to do is have a direct relationship with our customer and not rely on intermediaries, whether they're online or brick and mortar, to sell our tickets. One of the reasons that we don't want that is because we are so different, and it takes a little marketing to explain that when you buy a ticket on Southwest, you're not going to also have to pay for bags. You're not going to be subject to a change fee. For a number of reasons, we need our customers to come directly to our site so we can explain all those things, and we also want an opportunity to sell our credit card and get people to join up to our frequent flyer program.
What city would you like to be in that you aren't?
Well, I think Honolulu would be a good example, and it's next up in our plans, or Hawaii is, I should say, and we've announced that we'll add Hawaii flights beginning in 2018, and we're very excited about that.
What about internationally? Do you ever see a day when Southwest flies to Europe?
You know, I don't anytime soon. It's back to that never say never phrase. 737 is a very versatile airplane. It will absolutely do the mission from the U.S. to the U.K. as an example. But it's really not on our list at this point. We've got more than enough opportunities in the 48 states and then more broadly throughout North America to really grow the airline by 400 or 500 airplanes over a generation. I think with a codeshare partner, we'll likely serve Europe and Asia in the not-too-distant future, but even that is a lower priority at this point.
Southwest famously made a smart bet on fuel before oil prices jumped many years ago, and while all the other airlines' fuel costs went up, yours didn't. But more recently, you've had some problems with fuel hedging. Do you think it's still a good idea to do that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I wouldn't agree that it's a problem. The way that we think about fuel hedging is just like insurance. So if you own a home, you're going to have homeowners insurance. You're not hoping for a fire, but you certainly need the coverage in the event you have a catastrophe. And the worst thing that can happen is a fuel price spike. In the 2007-2008 time period, airlines went bankrupt. Airlines had to lay off employees, they had to cut back service, and we flew right through that because we had that protection in place. The last several years, when oil prices have collapsed, we've had the highest earnings in our history. Even though we're paying above market prices because of our hedging, we're still very, very profitable. Because prices are lower today, we're less aggressive with our hedging program, but we'll always hedge.
As you know, we've been having a national debate about sexual harassment. A lot of people have lost their jobs. Have you had to deal with that at Southwest? Have people been fired for that kind of thing?
Well, over time, absolutely. Most people, the vast majority of people, have character. They have tremendous integrity. They're honest. They deal with each other in a very civilized way. Our mantra here is that we live by the golden rule. But, occasionally, yeah, there are some that don't fit the criteria and they have to go. But we certainly haven't seen anything like we're experiencing in the news here recently. But over 46 years, yeah, occasionally we have issues like that and we deal with it.
I want to ask you about tax cuts because Southwest currently pays a pretty high effective tax rate, around 36% or 37%. Percent, but there are estimates that if this tax cut package does make it through in Washington, that you could save maybe hundreds of millions of dollars. If that happens, What are you going to do with that? Are you going to hire more people? Are you going to raise wages?
Well, what you described is accurate with the Senate version and the House versions as we know them today. And I would just say, first of all, that transportation as an industry, including the airlines, has been significantly disadvantaged with the tax schemes over the decades. And that makes us less competitive with other industries in terms of attracting capital because our cost of capital is simply higher. So this levels the playing field, and we would welcome that. In terms of what we would do with the money, we'll put it to work. We have opportunities to grow the fleet faster, create more jobs. In addition to that, we have the opportunity to consider renewing our fleet faster and retiring some of the older aircraft. So this would be a trade for quieter airplanes, more fuel-efficient airplanes, and I think that would be a significant benefit. That may not drive jobs at Southwest, but it would drive more jobs at Boeing, as an example, so that would certainly be an economic stimulus. But in addition to those investments, it's an opportunity for us to share those gains with our employees and
also
share
those
gains.
So you think wages will go up?
Well, first of all, we're 85% unionized, and those contracts are negotiated over time. But the more prosperous the company is, absolutely, the better position we are to increase wages, maintain a great healthcare program, and then our retirement program is anchored by a profit sharing. So to the extent our profits go up, certainly our profit sharing and retirement accounts go up.
What's the biggest challenge on the horizon for you?
Competition. You know, times are good. The airline industry is very cyclical, so it's not always like this, like we're seeing in 2017 and the outlook we have for 2018. What that means, of course, is that all of our competitors are, for the first time in my 30-plus years in the company, that I can say that all of our competitors are healthy, and therefore they're all aggressive, and they're growing. So that is the number one challenge, and we welcome it. We just want to continue to make Southwest better so that we can maintain our competitive advantages.
That's Gary Kelly, the CEO of Southwest Airlines. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's been a pleasure.
In Puerto Rico, it's been a slow recovery after Hurricane Maria. According to the Puerto Rican government, only about 60% of the original power grid has been restored, and that makes it hard to get back to normal, not just for adults, but for kids, too. There's been early dismissal from school since the storm, so many students are taking advantage of a new after-school program. Jeff Cohen from member station WNPR reports.
School started again in mid-November in the mountain town of Orocovis, 2 months after Maria passed. There's still no electricity, so that means that the school day ends early at 12:30. But today, 51 children are staying behind for more. Before they split up for activities, they begin with a lot of song. It's a program that parents say is a safe place for their kids after school. That leaves parents time for work and for dealing with the daily stress of living without basic services. It's organized by volunteers and the nonprofit Save the Children. Today includes gardening, arts, and some outdoor playtime. Science teacher Wanda Medina says the children are still missing a little bit of what it means to be a kid. Medina says she did an informal survey of her students, and she asked them this. After the hurricane, would humans or Mother Nature bounce back more quickly? And they all answered Mother Nature. The children told her that's because trees are already growing leaves, but they lost things they can't get back. Valuables their parents got them. Three of the students in her class lost their houses entirely. Parent and volunteer Giovanni Caballero Fuentes was luckier. His family didn't lose its house, but his kids watched as Maria ripped off their neighbor's roof. Now he says he's hoping they forget the sound of the wind and the rain, and that they learn to deal with life without electricity, without water, and without technology. Caballero Fuentes says there's no internet, no Facebook, no YouTube, no Instagram, no nothing.
Volvimos a lo básico, back to basic.
So he plays board games at home with his kids, and they look for other ways to distract themselves. Still, his daughter Nadia is happy to be in the after-school program. She's 10.
In English.
10.
How's your English?
Very nice.
And do you like your after-school program? Why?
Because it's very fun.
Luis Santiago came to pick up his grandson.
Janiel Omar Santiago, that's his name.
Santiago says Janiel often stays with him because his daughter works two jobs. He's a retired elementary school teacher, and he says he knows how important routine is for kids.
It's a little bit difficult, you know, have normality. We don't go to the movie, we don't go to the places where before we can go. But before I was from grade, but now it's a very difficult.
Eugenio Soto Santiago teaches at the school in Orocovis and led the afternoon's activities. He says many of the children first thought that their island would never be the same. With the translation help of his colleague, Denise Y. Salinas, who worked with Save the Children, he says small bits of regular life are now coming back into view.
Aunque no hay luz, no tenemos luz todavía. A veces no tenemos agua.
Even though we don't have electricity, and sometimes we don't have water, they're returning back to that this is our new normal, and they're able to handle it.
And there's that other thing that helps with the healing. Lots and lots of singing. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Cohen in San Juan.
More than 50 world leaders joined bankers and energy officials in Paris today on what is the second anniversary of the Paris Climate Accord. But they were holding a new climate summit, one that's a direct response to President Trump pulling out of the Paris Accord last June. Hours after Trump made that announcement this summer, French President Emmanuel Macron unveiled his Make Our Planet Great Again grants, a contest for climate scientists to relocate to France. He awarded 18 of those grants today. The BBC's Hugh Schofield joins us from Paris. And Hugh, President Trump wasn't invited to this summit, which Macron hopes will jumpstart the Paris Climate Accord. So who did come from the U.S.?
It was just the chargé d'affaires on the sort of federal level. It was just the chargé d'affaires from the embassy, so pretty low level. But of course, there were many other players, from governors, city leaders, philanthropists, business leaders, Bill Gates, Schwarzenegger, Bloomberg, Jerry Brown, governor of California. So, you know, no lack of Americans. And of course, their message is the one we've heard them put out many times, that don't judge America by Donald Trump. Don't believe that just because the federal government has opted out, that the sub-national level of American governance has opted out. They're still there, and they're saying that they can contribute just as much as America could have, would have, you know, had it not left. I mean, I think they're slightly overplaying it, because obviously there is a huge gap felt by the absence of the country, of the state, of the federal government. And that is, there's no question, you know, it's a huge blow to the Paris Accord, and there's pointless pretending otherwise. But if there is some compensation from the American point of view and from the French point of view, it's that there are these other players at the subnational level. And in a way, that's becoming more important. That's very much the focus of this summit. It's not, you know, government leaders necessarily just talking among each other in a kind of UN framework. It's a framework here that brings together all sorts of players, business leaders, philanthropists, local government.
Yeah. Well, you have Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York, pointing out that a private sector coalition, it's called America's Pledge, represents half of the U.S. economy, and they promise to honor the goals of the Paris Accord. You have John Kerry, former Secretary of State, pointing out 38 states have legislation, 90 major American cities support the Paris Accord. But still, as you say, it's not the full force of the American government. And yet we hear that some initiatives, some announcements have been coming forward. What's been happening? It's not just symbolic.
No, Macron is very much a kind of action kind of guy. And he, you know, he says he understands perfectly when the critics grow frustrated with all these conferences. He wants this conference to be different, because he says there will be actual pledges, initiatives announced. There are, for example, coalitions building up of investment funds, for example, who are saying, right, we are now going to monitor, for example, the 100 biggest greenhouse gas emitters in the world, the big energy producers, and we are going to monitor them closely to see if they are fulfilling their pledges and their commitments under the Paris Accord. And if they're not, then obviously we will start withdrawing some of our funding from those energy producers. So it's this kind of non-state coalition coalitions of interest, which he wants to see building up. And I think we will see some announcements of that nature, with pledges to, you know, move the economy and move finance towards this non-carbon future.
Well, you talk about Macron trying to perhaps position himself. There is a leadership vacuum. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel isn't there. She was once seen as a leader on curbing emissions. Of course, the U.S. is not represented. But does Macron hope to, you know, re-engage the U.S.? It doesn't seem likely if he's doing things like bringing 18 climate scientists, you know, giving them these multimillion dollar awards to relocate to France for the rest of President Trump's term to do their work there.
No, I suppose what President Macron is probably thinking of is in the longer term. Technically, the Americans haven't yet left the Paris Accord. I mean, there's a sort of period in which that has to kind of be activated. And it really, that period goes right down to 2020 when there's another election. Now, I'm sure Mr. Macron would not wish to weigh in any way on the next presidential election, but you can see, but possibly he's calculating that there might be another tenant after that. And there is, as we've heard, a big constituency in America that is for the Paris Accord, and he's speaking to them.
Yeah. Well, and people like Michael Bloomberg are actually thanking Donald Trump for creating sort of a rallying cry to jumpstart again the Paris Accords. The BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. Hugh, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, then. Cheerio.
Well, let's pivot to response to another environmental disaster, and it's quite a pivot because we're going to Lake Erie and issues in the lake that take center in a new oratorio from Cleveland composer Margaret Brouwer, who is inspired by public hearings and court cases. Elizabeth Miller of WCPN IdeaStream has more on the piece and its recent premiere.
On the stage, choirs of children and adults, rows of musicians, four soloists, and a conductor perform a piece of music. But the real star of Voice of the Lake is Lake Erie. The piece is all about the beauty of the lake and the people who use it for recreation and commerce. But there's more. A polluted past, toxic algae blooms, and contaminated sediment being dumped into the lake. Composer Margaret Brouwer started working on the environmental oratorio a couple of years ago.
I read in the Cleveland Plain Dealer about all the issues, the algae, and then the big conflict about whether to dump the dredged bottom of the Cuyahoga River into the lake. And so I started thinking it would make a great musical drama.
It was little more than a year ago that many of us, including citizens from around the region, elected officials and environmental groups.
She even uses testimony from public hearings on the dredging of the Cuyahoga River. That includes a statement from Congresswoman Marcia Fudge, who represents Greater Cleveland.
I use the transcripts because they told the story better than I could do myself. It's all actually pretty factual information.
Angela Mitchell performed the soprano role in the recent premiere in Cleveland. She describes a part of the piece known as the public hearing.
There's at one point the tenor comes in and is acting as the Army Corps of Engineers person.
Don't think about the swimmers. Don't think about the drinking water. Don't think about the fish. Put the dredged river bottom in the lake. In the lake, it's best.
And the soprano comes back saying, no, we need to care for this natural resource. We cannot just keep dumping this dredged river bottom in the lake.
How can you discount the findings of the EPA?
In reality, that drama is over for now. A federal judge has ordered the Corps of Engineers to place dredged sediment into containers instead of the lake. But there's still the issue of cleaning up decades of pollution and stopping new pollution. Margaret Brouwer tackles this with a visual presentation. As the instrumental ensemble plays, projected images show the effects of pollution. Shut down beaches, slimy-looking green algae, brown water traveling to a sewer. But the video also shows efforts to reduce pollution. Neighborhoods building rain gardens to slow the flow of water into sewers, rivers, and lakes. The region's new storage tunnels that limit sewer overflows during storms. And a photo of a farm that uses techniques to reduce soil erosion and improve water quality. The piece ends with a sunrise on the lake. Birds singing and the children's choir wondering if the water will be clean enough to swim.
Is
Conductor Domenico Boyajian says Voice of the Lake is a way for classical music and its fans to help restore Lake Erie.
Everyone has their own way of being able to approach the situation. Either watch where you throw your plastic, or don't pollute the river if you're a corporation, or let's write a piece about and let people know what's going on.
Right now, the piece stands as an oratorio, which is kind of like a staged reading or a concert. There are no costumes, props, or sets. But Brouwer initially imagined the piece as an opera, and still might write it as one. She also wants to see the music performed elsewhere.
There are lakes with this very similar problems in other parts of the country and also in China. So, I mean, you know, there's always a hope that this might get some performances many places.
For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
Some big deals to talk about in technology. Apple is buying the music identification app Shazam for $400 million, and Verizon has signed a $1.5 billion deal with the NFL to stream games. Let's get to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor for Recode. He joins us now. Hi, Ed.
Hey.
And let's start with Apple and Shazam. Why did Apple want to buy this service?
Apple rarely buys companies, so whenever they do a deal, one like this, hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, it's notable. It's also notable because it's basically an app, and you know, people are probably familiar with it. It basically identifies music. You're hearing it on a radio.
Right.
What is this again? And you know, it was an early hit, but it's not. It sort of waned in popularity, but it's still an important app in the sense that it's one of the few that does this.
Well, and one of the things I was thinking about as a possible reason that Apple would want to have this app is if you're out and you hear a song and you Shazam it, the first thing you might want to do is buy it, and Apple wants you to buy it from them.
Apple wants you to buy it from them. It also sort of locks you more into the Apple ecosystem, their iOS, right? Their phone system, that operating system that kind of runs everything now. Later down the road, though, you know, Shazam also has the ability to sort of identify objects via camera. And, you know, voice identification and visual identification as it relates to artificial intelligence is sort of an area that Apple and Amazon and Facebook, all the big tech companies, are really trying to own and dominate. And this certainly could help them in that quest.
Now, the BBC reports that the $400 million takeover is among the most expensive Apple acquisitions, but Recode called the deal a discount. Why?
Well, Shazam itself as a startup had been valued at 2-3 times more that in the past. And so this is, you know, this is definitely a discount from that earlier valuation. I think that's a sign of, you know, finding your exit properly, but also just sort of these big companies, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, as I talked about, they've so dominated that it's much harder for a startup in the Web 2.0 era to kind of find that new dominance. So that's where that discount is coming from. The incumbents are established and they sort of, you know, determine pricing at this point.
And what about this Verizon deal? Verizon is going to pay $1.5 billion over 5 years to stream live NFL games to its subscribers. What do we know about this deal?
So it's $1.5 billion is a pretty big number.
Yeah.
It's actually 50% more than the last deal that Verizon paid for NFL rights. The thing to note also that it's rights to stream these games to mobile phones and to tablets, not necessarily to desktop or to internet-connected TVs. And I think that's sort of an interesting difference because that's another right that the NFL can and probably will sell, whether it's to, say, Amazon or CBS or some other digital player potentially down the road. The NFL's really done a great job in slicing up these media rights as finely as possible to get as much money as they can.
Well, and when a company is willing to pay $1.5 billion for that, it really makes you think that the way that we will watch sporting events in the future and maybe even now is going to be on a phone or on a device rather than on a TV, or maybe you link it up to your TV, but you're getting the service from your phone provider rather than the cable company.
Right, and especially for younger people, watching things on their phones is pretty much a standard thing now for them. It's not for me personally. I can't quite do that, but I see people all the time just watching entertainment on their phones.
Now, there's another story we have to ask you about, and we've been talking about it now for a while, which is Bitcoin.
Bitcoin, yes.
Well, we've got the first 24 hours of Bitcoin on Wall Street as futures contracts on the Chicago Board Options Exchange. What happened?
So it had a nice pop, 20%, whatever it is. It's still trading higher. So basically, the futures contract is saying, we think Bitcoin is going to be worth $18,000 in a few months. It's currently worth, the actual Bitcoin is worth $17,000 and change. So there's a price differential there. It's banking on, you're betting on the idea that the price will go up. What's weird, though, is that there isn't any real convergence, at least not yet. We're only 2 days into it, between the options price or the futures price and the actual price. And at some point, those things usually converge. But if they don't, what you're going to have is sort of an asset that's trading, you know, a derivative, what they call it, which is what a future is, trading irrespective of the underlying asset. And that's even weirder than Bitcoin itself in a lot of ways. So it's bizarre. It does allow other, like, hedge funds and big institutional investors to jump into the Bitcoin mania more readily, more easily. That's what futures allow. But again, it's like, I think a lot of people are still scratching their heads as to what the real value of either of these things are right now.
Well, and what about the issue of regulation? We had the SEC committee chairman Jay Clayton issuing a 2,000-word statement yesterday warning investors to exercise extreme caution with Bitcoin. What kind of control or influence does the SEC have when it comes to Bitcoin?
Well, over Bitcoin itself, nothing. And that was the whole conceit of Bitcoin, is that it's a currency that operates outside the bounds of any one government or any one entity. At the same time, though, you know, these futures contracts, or basically converting these Bitcoins into dollars, that is something that the SEC and government regulators can have more say over. And in a weird way, these futures that we're talking about earlier might, in a weird way, be more stable, just because it's monitored and backed by a lot of banks and exchanges and, of course, monitored by the SEC.
That's Ed Lee, managing editor for Recode. Ed, thank you.
Anytime.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.